who went to Syria to do nothing more than to help civilians there caught in the middle of the strife.
The gruesome murders of kidnapped journalists James Foley and Stephen Sotloff have engendered, along with horror and sadness, serious questions about the way the media should cover such violence. When are news images, even if not graphic, simply too suggestive? When does even circumspect coverage of a sensational crime fulfill the goals of the perpetrators? And there's yet another ethical quandary, one created by the media themselves. Is it ever right to black out coverage of a kidnapping altogether? Such moratoria have become common, most notably the 2008 kidnapping in Afghanistan of New York Times reporter David Rode. The Times asked other news organizations to be silent, and the media blackout held for 7 months until his escape. Subsequent hostage takings led to similar pacts of silence, a practice that found favor with the Committee to Protect Journalists. But amid the recent epidemic of journalist abductions, the committee is having second thoughts. Executive Director Joel Simon says the media blackout strategy took shape after a flurry of kidnappings in Iraq and the murder of kidnapped American journalist Daniel Pearl in Pakistan in 2002.
Their goal all along was to inflict the maximum emotional damage through his execution, and the sympathetic media coverage, the emotional orchestrated public campaign, actually heightened their ability to achieve that goal.
And after that, in Afghanistan, the kidnapping of an Italian journalist and his Afghan driver and fixer, the kidnappers truly toyed with not only the emotions, but the lives of these men. Tell me about it.
Well, yes, this was an absolutely horrible incident. The kidnappers, which were Afghan Taliban, executed the driver. They cut off his head. And then they used the intensive media coverage to put pressure on the Italian government, which in turn put pressure on the Afghan government to release Taliban prisoners, which they did. As a result, Italian reporter Daniel Mastrogiacomo was released, and then the Taliban went back to President Karzai of Afghanistan and demanded the release of additional prisoners for the Afghan journalists. When Karzai refused to do that, they executed the Afghan fixer. This exploitation of the media to achieve their political objectives of both winning the release of these prisoners and damaging Karzai rattled journalists and the media community because it was so effective.
So then the decision not to aid and abet terrorists by giving them the very publicity they seek. How did you come in years past to subscribe to the strategy of the blackout?
To try to limit the ability of the kidnappers to use the media to achieve their political goals. And if there's a possibility of some negotiation of paying a ransom, then trying to conduct a ransom negotiation in the glare of the media spotlight is difficult, if not impossible. If you've got the media banging at the door, that just makes the crisis even more difficult.
And how much conversation was there in your offices of suppressing news for media colleagues when you wouldn't do it for a political figure or some other private citizen?
Most media organizations will say that they will apply blackouts in any circumstance, whether the victim is a journalist or not. But the reality is, it is journalists who know who to call when news breaks and it needs to be suppressed. If you are a media executive, you have relationships with other media executives, so it's much easier to ask for and get a blackout than it is for other folks. In most instances that I've seen, it's not a deliberate double standard. It's just a double standard that exists in practice.
News organizations, of course, try to keep their distance from governments, but sometimes the request to tamp down coverage comes from the government. Can you give me some examples?
Once the blackout practice becomes acceptable, governments utilize it. The Turkish government has demanded that the Turkish media not report kidnapping of Turkish diplomats by ISIS in Mosul. And the British government has asked that the British media not report on the name of the hostage that ISIS showed at the end of the video in which they executed Stephen Sotloff.
Was that the tipping point for you when governments began to dictate coverage to presumably independent media?
There wasn't one single factor that caused me to change my opinion. But one thing that really affected me was the change in dynamic in Syria. At one point, we had 30 journalists who were kidnapped. Most of those cases were blacked out. So you had a kidnapping epidemic that was simply not being covered. And the consequence was that there wasn't awareness about the growing risk to journalists and the fact that ISIS were actually hunting down journalists to kidnap. And it just wasn't clear to me what the benefit was in trying to secure the release of these journalists. Ultimately, the responsibility of the media is to report the news. Exceptions to that practice should be as rare as possible.
You speak to families of these journalists. The stakes for them are obvious. Should their wishes be part of the decision-making process? Should the issue of journalistic ethics trump the desire of the family to get their loved ones back alive?
It's a really, really difficult question. I think that if there is clear evidence that reporting specific information will further endanger a journalist who's been kidnapped, then obviously the family's wishes must prevail. But I think that in many instances, there's just a sense that it's better not to report the news. And in those circumstances, I think making the information public in an unemotional, just the facts way probably serves the broader purpose.
I gather that you knew some of these journalists before they were abducted, and yet you have come down ultimately to discourage the idea of non-reporting. That's a tough place to be.
Yes, but I have a secondary responsibility, which is to ensure that there's an awareness about risks that journalists face around the world. And I think one of the situations that caused me to change my view that we should be reporting on this, we should be making folks aware of what's happening. And the blackout is impeding our ability to do that.
All right. Joel, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joel Simon is Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. His post on the Columbia Journalism Review site about media blackouts is adapted from his forthcoming book, The New Censorship: Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. This week, hackers exploited security weaknesses and human frailty to steal and distribute nude images of several celebrities, including Oscar-winning actress Jennifer Lawrence. Unauthorized celebrity nudes are themselves not unusual. The sheer volume of stolen images, however, was, and so was the online backlash, branding onlookers not as curious media consumers, but as receivers of stolen property and peeping Toms. Most significant, perhaps, was the scene of the crime, namely Apple's iCloud storage network.
They want you to go to the cloud, and they're selling it as a great idea. Just, you don't need your stuff, just give it to us, we'll keep it on the cloud. You're like, really, but those are my pictures, and we'll keep it on the cloud.
As comedian Louis C.K. anticipated back in 2012, the cloud is vulnerable. Hackers managed to penetrate multiple layers of security to obtain the pictures. But how? Blogger Nick Brilovich decided to reverse engineer the crime, which began, he says, with a private subculture of nudie collectors who amassed and traded these images among themselves, like baseball cards, until one guy decided to sell off his cards outside the group.
The person that posted them, he was requesting that people in the forum pay him for receiving uncensored versions. The problem that he had is that nobody took him seriously. They resorted to posting the complete nude pictures, and it propagated from there on 4chan, on Twitter and on Reddit and the other sites. Other people that have these images saw that this person was trying to sell these images and then decided to do the same themselves. It was like a 12-hour frenzy within this group, where they went from being a super secret celebrity image trading network to being the biggest story in the world, all because one member tried to profit from the images that he had.
The hacks that we witnessed this week are frightening for a number of reasons, and right at the top of the list is, what if that were me? What are the security measures that are in place, and how can we optimize them?
So the main things that have been used to break into these accounts are the password reset mechanisms that every account has. And that mechanism is usually protected by a secret question and a secret answer, which everybody fills out when they sign up for an account, and then they usually completely forget about it. But Apple and other providers have a mechanism where you forget your password, it will prompt you with these questions to prove who you are, and then we'll hand the account over to you.
The name of your first pet, the color of your first car, your dad's middle name, that sort of thing?
Now, the problem for celebrities is that this information is very easy to discover. The other way that they find this data is that there are web-based data sets that people can pay money to query, where they can retrieve a person's credit reports, phone book information, from which you can begin to deduce your mother's maiden name, favorite sports team. What users can do is go into their Apple accounts. In the area where it asks for your secret question, change the answers to something that an attacker couldn't easily guess. For instance, if it asks, what is your favorite sports team? Instead of putting in the Yankees, put in a long phrase from Shakespeare or something completely unrelated.
So if you're not already obscure, make yourself obscure by having security questions address things that are not public and really, really hard to discover. But that's not the only pathway in. What are the others?
So the other pathways in is to socially engineer or to phish somebody. Phishing is where the attacker would send the victim an email pretending to be a service that that victim uses. In this case, they've crafted an email that looks exactly like it came from Apple, asks the user to enter their username and password. And if the user falls for it, the hacker would have captured that information and then used it to log into the user's account. One of the guys on the forums claimed that his success rate with these emails is over 30%.
So I'm a bad guy because you're careless. I've successfully gotten into your iCloud account. What happens next?
With a username and password, they have software that pretends to be an iPhone that goes to the Apple servers and says, I'm an iPhone from this user, and they've just lost all of their data. So give me a copy of all of their phone data that you've got on your server so that I can restore the phone for them. It's used all the time with people who accidentally delete an image on their phone, or they might drop their phone in the ocean and lose all their data. From Apple's perspective, it's actually very difficult to distinguish the difference between a real phone and this software that's used by the hackers to retrieve this data.
They said, hey, you know, there's no bug. It's not our problem. First of all, am I paraphrasing it correctly? And if so, is that a satisfactory response?
I believe their response was iCloud wasn't compromised, but some users who use iCloud may have been compromised in attacks that were very targeted. I don't believe their response was satisfactory because most users came away blaming the victims and then not learning anything from it. There are very good reasons why Apple accounts made up the vast majority of accounts that were compromised here. And that's because the other cloud providers, such as Google and Microsoft, have over a decade of experience in defending from these types of attacks. So it's very disappointing that they're not using this incident to change some of their practices. And the best thing that they could do would be to remove the ability to reset somebody's password using nothing more than a date of birth and two secret questions and answers.
And replace it with what? Until we have biometrics where you can just put your fingerprint on the screen and be recognized, there's got to be some means of authenticating the user.
Authenticating the user depends on that value being a secret. It's from an era where knowing somebody's mother's maiden name was difficult to find, or knowing somebody's date of birth was difficult to find. And the way around it is for the provider to give you a code when you sign up that you would print out and store in a safe place.
All right. I just want to say one final thing, Nick, and that is that my mother's maiden name, Schmeckle-Meckledorfer. Nick, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Nick Kubrilovich is a serial entrepreneur, a blogger, and a hacker. We spoke to him from Australia. Coming up, the natives are gutless. They say they properly label native advertising from surrounding editorial content, but they don't. This is On the Media.
On the next Illinois Pioneers on WILL-TV, I sit down with Shozo Sato, professor emeritus of art and design at the University of Illinois. He's dedicated his life to the idea that art can be a bridge between cultures. And as an author, kabuki theater director, and founder of the original Japan House, he has helped spread Japanese culture to the West. I'm David Inge. Join me for Illinois Pioneers Thursday night at 7:30 on WILL-TV.
Support comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, with instructions in Iyengar Yoga, with special classes for men, women 50+, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start the first week of September. Details at yoga-cu.com or 344-YOGA.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Native advertising, as we have previously discussed on this program, is the practice of publishing material prepared by or for marketers that resembles the actual editorial content surrounding it. Back in the prosperous old days, it was called advertorial and represented a marginal segment of the ad industry. But suddenly, it is in vogue, because now that advertising mainly lives online, where consumers can decide whether to view ads or not, at least 95.5% of us encountering obvious advertising vote no.
Did you know that if you ever actually click on a banner ad, you literally get taken to a page that reads, "Hey, is everything okay? I'm presuming you passed out and hit your head on the keyboard. I'm calling an ambulance right now."
That was John Oliver on HBO's Last Week Tonight, getting to the nub of the problem. Because we in the audience treat all ads as spam, an overwhelming percentage of online publishers have rushed to help marketers make the spam look more like real ham. Despite industry guidelines on clear labeling, standard practice is the opposite. Identical text fonts, layout, and headline treatment for everything on the page. Even the most prominent publications employ wiggle words, such as sponsored content, to avoid identifying an ad as an ad, while claiming total transparency. Till now, one paragon of truth in labeling has been the New York Times. But recently, even the Times has softened restrictions. For instance, by significantly lightening the shade of the blue bar denoting native, and by saying, instead of paid for and posted by Dell, simply paid post. The matter of flimsy disclosure has captured the attention of the FTC, which is considered regulating native. In anticipation, Professor David J. Franklin of the University of San Francisco School of Law has been researching readers' ability to distinguish native ads from editorial content, and at least half of us, he says, cannot. I asked him if the relatively subtle backsliding by the Times should alarm us.
We should be concerned, and we should be, I think, a little bit angry and appropriately rebellious. David Hyman from the University of Illinois and I are doing this research under the auspices of the McCarthy Institute for the Study of Consumer Perceptions Online. And we're doing it because we are afraid or angry or concerned or have a hypothesis that some big cultural shift is going on. And it's been going on for, I think, about the last 10 years. And it is this erosion of the boundary between independent editorial content and paid content, and the erosion of consumers' ability to differentiate between the two, and then the conditioning of consumers' willingness to accept it. So what do you do about it now? I was at a FTC conference last December where the FTC realized this was a problem. It gathered together a lot of people. Most of the people weren't academics like myself. They were people from industry who were engaged in native advertising. They took the stage one after another and proceeded to explain to the FTC regulators who were sitting in the audience how it was in their self-interest, in their company's interest, in their client's interest to make sure all of this was very transparent and very disclosed, because if they didn't do a good job at that, they would ultimately, their clients, the brands, would lose the trust of consumers. And I thought to myself, you've got to be kidding. I can't believe they're sitting here and expecting us to believe this.
Now, David, I have to say, I was at the same conference.
Okay.
I was presenting at that conference, and I was saying aloud what you were thinking, which is that these people are lying. Because while everyone got up there testifying that it was in their best interest to disclose, in practice, they were all going through all sorts of gymnastics not to disclose.
Precisely.
Including these extremely fuzzy terms like sponsored post. It's not hard to disclose advertising. You know what word works very well? Advertising. Nobody is using that term at all. But the FTC was paying attention. What are they going to do?
That's why I'm doing the research with Professor Hyman. We're trying to figure out what can be done and to develop empirical evidence to say, hey, this is what works. You've got to say paid advertisement. You've got to say it here at the top and at the bottom, not over here, you know, off to the left, which is the word paid post. And we're experimenting with other disclosures because we want to put together a set of some data that will support real best practices. And I don't think this industry is self-regulating well. They don't want to be regulated. That was clear from the conference.
There's two sides to this conversation. One has to do with simple consumer protection. But the other question is, what is at stake editorially? If publishers let advertisers camouflage themselves as editorial content, they're doing so because editorial content confers exactly the trust you were just describing, right? What happens if you barter away the very trust that is the soul of your enterprise?
I think a lot of things happen. Ultimately, the risks that we're facing are a drying up of a truly independent editorial media that speaks its mind, that speaks its opinion, that criticizes the government, that we know when it's criticizing the government, it's not being paid to do so necessarily by somebody, that we can differentiate between information that we think is reliable and can trust and information that we don't think is reliable and we don't trust, not just so we can make purchasing decisions, but so that we have media with some degree of editorial independence and integrity, and that doesn't feel it has to compromise that at every turn just to stay in business. Because if you can't beat them, you better join them.
And there's my question for you, David. Is the New York Times suddenly joining them?
Yeah, I think it is. The very fact that they have entered this market in a way which includes writing some of these advertorials apparently in-house, it's startling. It isn't the New York Times I grew up with. So yeah, I think we should all take a breath and have a pause of reflection about this moment in our media cultural development and ask whether we are being sufficiently attentive to the erosion of trust values that we have otherwise tried to protect.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
David J. Franklin is professor and director at the McCarthy Institute for Intellectual Property and Technology Law at the University of San Francisco School of Law. We contacted the New York Times, which declined to make anyone available for an interview. On September 10th, we might see a lot of the dreaded spinning wheel of death, that symbol that appears when a web page is loading slowly. It's a gimmick contrived by a coalition of advocacy groups to stimulate public comment on the FCC website in favor of net neutrality and against letting internet service providers charge rich websites tolls for faster service while slowing down everyone else. The idea is to trigger outrage, much as we saw in the fight against the legislation called SOPA that would have given broader rights to ISPs to block content they deemed as pirated. But never fear, says Parker Higgins of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the spinning wheel will just be animation. The internet won't really be slowing down.
Right. It's as if the internet's going slow, as sort of a reminder to people
why it's so important that everybody has access to the same kinds of internet speeds.
All right, so here's what you're up against. Parker, say the words net neutrality. Just say them out loud.
Net neutrality. Did you fall asleep for a second? I mean, even the guy who coined net neutrality has said, well, I didn't know that we were going to be talking about it so much, or I would have chosen something less boring. What we've seen is even wrapped in this really boring name, you know, already the FCC has gotten over a million comments on this issue, and already it's been in the news, and we've seen a lot of momentum. And we're hoping that, given the September 10th action, where we've got a number of sort of major online destinations that are signing up to take part, that people will dig a little deeper and realize that even though it's not the most exciting name, it's absolutely related to things that people care about deeply.
So what you have going for you is this history, unaccountable history of public interest in this, as you say, arcane policy issue. What you have working against you is some jurisprudence. Can you tell me about the U.S. Appeals Court decision that kind of triggered this whole discussion?
Sure. The FCC had previously written a set of open internet rules, which they thought would more or less assure net neutrality, and then those rules were taken to court by ISPs. And the court found that the rules were unenforceable based on the classification. So as long as you call ISPs, internet service providers, a certain kind of service, the FCC doesn't have enough power over them to regulate the rules.
But if you were to call them a common carrier,
right,
then all of a sudden the regulatory environment would change.
Yes, we're looking for reclassification. We'd want to make sure that the reclassification is done right and that doesn't give the FCC too much power. But there's a way to do this that would end with a more neutral net and really an outcome that we could all be satisfied with. The reason that there's any pushback against reclassification at all is that it requires a lot of political will. You know, there are people, especially cable companies and ISPs, that won't be elated to be in this new category, but it's something that the FCC has the political power to do.
The chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, is of the telecom industry. That's where he came from. And now he has a lot of power to dictate the FCC's path here. In the end, does it really matter how many millions of complaints the FCC fields if the game is rigged in the telecom's favor?
Well, if the game is really rigged, then we're in trouble. But you know, the FCC is made up of largely good people who want to do the right thing. And I think that it's really hard to look at more than a million really thoughtful comments from people and say, okay, but we're going to do what these handful of cable companies want us to do. And so it's not a sure thing, but that's why we're really trying to make sure that we get one last push of comments before they close this round and really let the FCC know this is not something that people are just going to ignore. You know, I don't want to jinx it, but I think that we're coming to a good place where the FCC realizes what the right thing to do is.
Parker Higgins is an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in issues at the intersection of freedom of speech, copyright, trademark, and patent law.
Parker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Did somebody say net neutrality?
Coming up, Jarl and Carl, NPR's incoming president and NPR's outgoing voice of news and quiz scores. This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, at roadscholar.org. TiVo, delivering cable TV, on-demand, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus from a single device. Learn more at TiVo.com. And Wix.com, giving business owners the ability to create their own website with a drag-and-drop builder. Learn more at Wix.com. This is NPR.
Fresh Air's book critic Maureen Corrigan has just written a book about the novel she loves more than any other. The novel she and many other critics consider the greatest American novel, The Great Gatsby. In writing about Gatsby, she also writes about herself as a reader and teacher. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Maureen about her new book, So We Read On. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The top job at NPR is a very popular position, in the sense that lately pretty much the entire U.S. population has occupied it. Since 2009, there have been five, count them, five NPR CEOs, the latest of whom assumed his duties this summer. Yarrow Mohn, a broadcasting veteran with deep roots in both commercial and public radio, took the reins from interim CEO Paul Haga, who had temporarily replaced Gary Nell, who joined Nat Geo Channel after only 2 years, after replacing interim CEO Joyce Slocum, who jumped in to replace Vivian Schiller, who lasted only 2 years before running headlong into political buzzsaws. Yarrow Mohn hopes for a longer tenure, but it might not be a cakewalk. Yarrow, welcome to On the Media.
Well, thank you.
You've inherited a $6 million operating deficit. A lot of member stations are down in the mouth or up in arms. About half the U.S. Congress sees NPR as the Antichrist. You've lost some of your most experienced journalists to buyouts, and technology threatens to make your business model obsolete. Congratulations on the new gig, Yarl.
We love a challenge.
Challenges. It seems to me the biggest one, and it's almost 15 years in the making, is NPR's very operating model.
Mm-hmm.
The network gets most of its revenue from member stations who write you checks in exchange for programming like Morning Edition and All Things Considered. But in the digital age, you don't really, strictly speaking, need their broadcast hours anymore. You can deliver all your programming online in real time. How do you preserve local public radio, and how do you embrace technology while still getting the bills paid?
You really have to do both of them. My background is radio. I think radio is the most personal, the most powerful medium. It's the heritage of the organization. It's our past. It's our present. I think it's going to be our future for a long, long time. That said, we also have to be where our listeners and users are. Many people are using digital platforms, whether it's mobile, whether it's iPads, in addition to the terrestrial platforms. And with a connected car, that's going to be probably even more of a factor. And the stations, like WNYC, or where I came from, KPCC in Los Angeles, are hugely important and are going to be the backbone and the foundation for the system for, I think, many, many, many years to come.
Your roots are in commercial broadcast, and that's where you made your sizable fortune. But you've been a very large donor and an active board member at KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Which guy did the NPR board hire, the commercial guy or the KPCC guy?
They hired both. I don't think I could have ever been considered for this position had it not been for the work I did at KPCC, 12 years of being on a board of a public station, and many of those years as chair. But I think my background in commercial media, not just commercial radio, but on the cable television network side, and also the last 14 years of my career and as an angel investor in digital media properties. I think it's the whole range that is going to be helpful to me to address these issues you brought up at the open, having a legacy of being broadcast radio and at the same time part of the digital revolution.
Well, let's just say that terrestrial radio is a big part of NPR's future, but it still has to reckon with digital, and it's doing so most recently with a smartphone app called NPR One, which delivers a stream of public radio content from NPR as well as from local stations. Tell me about NPR One.
Well, it's been hugely successful in terms of the initial uptake. The idea is you download the app and then you can signify where you're listening so that you can get content from the local radio station. If you're in New York, you tap WNYC. Then what the app does is it starts to assemble a whole lineup of stories. You can skip them if you're not interested. If you think something is particularly interesting, it's not a like button, it's an interesting button. So the app learns the kinds of stories that you're interested in.
The app is configured so that it's sensitive to the local station at your location. Is receiving local content in addition to NPR content organic, or is it just something kind of bolted on to the app to appease the member stations?
No, we could go direct to the customer, and we could provide national news and international news and those interesting stories that provide driveway moments that people love. But local news is hugely important to anyone that's listening to public radio. We can't do that. We have to have partners. We have to be part of an ecosystem where we're providing some information, the station's providing a different set of information. So NPR One, to be a success, has to have that element.
You've said that you can generate a lot more underwriting revenue than NPR has been getting, that we've essentially been undervaluing our ad inventory considering the size and affluence of our audience, which makes perfect sense, but it also infuriates and terrifies some listeners who fear for NPR's independence and for its very soul. What can you say to talk them down?
They're not going to, as a listener, notice anything different. We're not talking about adding more units to each hour. The only thing that I think they might perceive differently is that we're going to be talking about brands that matter a little bit more to them, ones they're interested in. And we're going to ask for larger commitments from these underwriters. If you look at the cumulative reach of NPR in a week, we reach, just on terrestrial radio, close to 30 million people. The audience is growing. It's not just affluent. It's a smart audience. It's very engaged. What more could a brand want than this type of audience?
As other news organizations face collapse of their own business models, more and more, in addition to whole new enterprises, are turning to the NPR solution, corporate, individual, and foundation donors to underwrite a public good. Are we going to be in cutthroat competition with ProPublica and the Texas Tribune and the like? Are we going to be going to the mattresses?
I don't think we're going to be competing head-to-head with them. It's a tough thing to start from scratch. This is an organization that's been around for over 40 years. We've got 17 international bureaus. We've got 17 bureaus domestically. We have 800 people. We have a sound. News can be, in some cases, a commodity. Facts can be commodities, but storytelling, in my view, is not a commodity. As long as we continue to do what we've been doing and make it better, be the best storytellers on the planet, I'm not worried about the competitive set at all.
I want to ask you about our sound, especially as it relates to our image. In some quarters, and I'm speaking particularly of the Republican Party, NPR is regarded as Radio Havana or Radio Palestine. Mm-hmm. To some on the left, it's seen as a quisling media arm of the powers that be, and culturally, it continues to be kind of a punchline. You know, you listen to NPR in your Birkenstocks while eating kale salad and sipping artisan chai. Are those various caricatures telling in any way? Do they need to be addressed, or are they just simply the price of being an institution?
Well, I think, like many stereotypes, there was probably a time when that was not that off in terms of a reality. But that, I believe, was a long time ago. We have a very diverse audience, and our mission is to really make it more diverse. And I'm not just speaking of diversity in the racial and ethnicity realm. That's a huge part of it, of course. But it has to do with geographic diversity, different accents on the air, Southern accents, Boston accents. Diversity has to do with age and also political points of view, ideological points of view. It'll probably take a long time for that stereotype to die, but that won't be the reality.
All right, Jarl. I began this conversation with a whole laundry list of reasons why you're destined to fail and to go down in flames. What is going to happen?
What's going to happen with NPR and public radio? I think it's more important now than it's ever been. Look what's happened with newspapers. With a few exceptions, the newspaper business is really a very damaged business, and it's a very important community service. On cable television, whether ideologically left or ideologically right, or very exploitative and sensationalistic, there are very few places, I think, that you can get knowledge-based, fact-based journalism. People know that's important and want that. The challenge has been the economics of the business. I don't think we've asked the right people for the right amount of money. I don't think we have stepped up and thought as expansively and as broadly as we can about ourselves. My number one job here is to make sure that the people that work at NPR or in public radio, including the local stations, have the money and the tools and the resources to do the best work that they've ever done in their career.
Jarl, thank you very much. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Jarl Mohn is the CEO and president of NPR. From NPR's Jarl to NPR's Carl. Yes, the venerable Carl Castle, legendary newscaster and, wait, wait, don't tell me, scorekeeper, who retired from the network in May.
Ladies and gentlemen, Carl Castle.
Brooke sat with Carl recently to commemorate a distinguished and deeply baritone public radio career.
Who is that kid? His name is Hunter Flattery, son of our senior communications strategist at WNYC, Vicki Elkins, who told me this story today. A few months ago, on the drive back into Manhattan after a packed day full of errands and a visit to Grandma's, my husband heard a Grateful Dead song come on the radio and seized it for a father-son teaching moment. He turned up the radio, started jamming on his air guitar, looked at my son in the backseat and said, "Hunter, do you know who Jerry Garcia is? He's a legend. Do you know who he is?" And my son replied instantly, "No, but I know who Carl Castle is, so you can change the radio station back right now."
Good kid.
In an interview with Renee Montaigne, you said that when you were a really small kid, you knew you would be in radio. And you used to play with your grandmother's Victrola in Goldsboro, North Carolina.
I did. My mom would run me out in the yard so many times during the week. "Get out and play. Get away from the darn radio." It was one of those large furniture-size radios. And it sat in the corner of the living room. But I would get behind that radio sometimes, and nobody could see me. And when somebody walked by, I would pretend I was on the radio reading a commercial or doing some news and once in a while singing.
You worked at a local radio station part-time when you were in high school. You were an actor in local theater. One of your high school teachers was a bit of a theater aficionado. Could you put up picture 3?
That's Andy Griffith down the right-hand corner, and that was me, the Indian, the bottom picture. He was a great teacher, believe me. He helped me a lot. And sometimes during the summer when we were doing the show, we'd take off a couple of days, and I'd get out on the highway and hitch a ride back to my hometown. And pretty soon here come a beat-up station wagon and a Griffith's car.
Wow, that's so Mayberry.
It is very Mayberry. He'd take me home and pick me up the next day back to the theater. He was a great guy. He really was. I miss him a lot.
How did you wind up at NPR? We're talking about 1975.
Yeah.
They hired all these kids, and I wondered what your first impression was.
I'm always impressed by the good points about people. And I learned a lot just by working with them, and I think they learned something from me, too.
Like how to dress?
Yeah. You know, they come dressed up kind of sloppily from time to time, and I had to, set a precedent. I'd start wearing a tie and a jacket, trying to bring some class to this place. And some of them jumped in and started doing the same thing.
You told me backstage that some of them needed help, particularly Bob Edwards.
Bob Edwards needed a lot of help.
So now let's transition to Wait, Wait, Don't That's Tell it. Me, which premiered in January of 1998. Mm-hmm. Doug Berman found you and placed you in an unexpectedly comedic role.
Yeah.
Why?
Because of a joke I told one day. I was asked, "What time do you get up in the morning?" I said, "I get up at 5 minutes after 1 o'clock." "Well, why don't you get up at 1? "Because I like to sleep late." So that's how I got on Wait, Wait.
Some 2,200 people have your voice on their answering machine.
I know. So I know what the question is. I will not go beyond certain boundaries of good taste and keeping it clean.
But I read that you've been asked to put Rapper's Delight and What's New Pussycat on answering machines.
Yeah, I think I did record What's New, Pussycat, whoa, 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 whoa. If you recorded this tonight while I'm doing it, you've got a classic.
Tell me about when Barack Obama was a guest on Wait, Wait.
Well, he was a senator back in those days. And Peter said, now before you leave, Senator, we know that you have a big thing in mind to do in the very near future. Tell the American public tonight what it is so they can hear it here on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He hummed and hawed, and Peter just pounded away at him with, Senator, please. And finally he said, okay, Peter, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I got to go home and do the dishes. Good night.
Let's play video cue two.
Carl, for 30 years on Morning Edition, yours was the voice America woke up to. You brought us the news of everything from presidential elections to the fall of the Berlin Wall. We trusted you to tell us what happened and why it mattered. And then for some reason you joined a show where Peter Siegel makes you read goofy limericks and imitate everybody from Britney Spears to Barack Obama. It turns out they all sound like Carl Castle. Anyway, we're glad you did. Over the years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has become an institution in my hometown of Chicago and across the country. And Carl, you've been its heart and soul. I will never forget my time on the show. A lot of people didn't know my name, but you guys were already making fun of it. So, Carl, congratulations on an incredible career and a well-deserved retirement. We will miss you, but it's good to know you won't be giving up everything. Who knows, maybe in a few years you'll get a call from another contestant, Barack from Chicago. And if I win, I'm glad you will still record my voicemail.
Of 2010, you were inducted into the National Radio Hall of Fame. It was in the closely watched category of National Active Radio Personality. And you beat out Howard Stern. Now, he claimed that he didn't really want to be inducted, but he was kind of snotty about it anyway.
Who's Carl Cassell?
He has been on national radio.
What a career! He got himself all the way to National Public Radio? What a lucky duck. Wow. Give it to him. He's way more successful in this business than he's got to be. He's on NPR. Isn't that a national terrestrial thing?
My dear Mr. Stein, my understanding is that you're featured on a satellite information service available in some brands of cars on which you host a show about gynecology. While I am sure this is a useful service for medical professionals, like all of us in radio, you aspire to something greater. Best of luck to you.
Talk about another honor. Mm-hmm. You were the voice of the Kennedy Center Awards, and you did it unseen from a booth.
Yeah, they give me a little studio and a storage room in the back of the stage. I have a TV monitor and a script about so thick. And then the night of the show, everybody has to come dressed. Because when the show is over, they turn the lobby into a giant restaurant. I get to meet some people I had never met before. Not too long ago, I was looking for Stephen Colbert. And I walked over to him and said, Stephen, he says, Carl, I knew that was you introducing me.
It's funny you should mention him. I just so happen to have Stephen Colbert.
Stephen Colbert here, just saying what everyone else is thinking. All of us who loved you on NPR, all of us who listened for your voice every week on Wait, Wait, are so, so sad that you're gonna go. Send us some limericks or something. Very few things rhyme with Carl, by the way. I tried. The rhyming dictionary goes Carl, gnarl, and snarl. You were dealt a rough hand when it came to a first name, I gotta say, when it comes to rhyming. How ironic.
Ah, good old Stephen. He was such a good guy, a good friend.
I met him one time. I was going to be on the show, and he came in while I was getting my makeup on, and mm-hmm. he said what he apparently says to everybody before they go on the show, mm-hmm. which is, just remember, I'm an idiot.
That's Stephen.
I have to tell you, though, you've gotten a Peabody, or probably 10 Peabodys, I don't know. But the award that I'm most envious of is this one.
Oh, yeah. The Simpsons.
It's so much fun to finally have a friend who likes the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me as much as I do.
So, Carl Castle, how did the House Minority Whip do on our news quiz?
Well, Peter, he got 2 out of 3 right. So, he wins me recording his outgoing message.
Oh, that's okay, really. No, no, no. Please don't.
It's not optional.
So, Carl, what's up next?
Well, I want to try to find a way to get back into the NPR building. People have brought up the word retirement for me, and it's not in my vocabulary. Dick Smothers told me one time, he says, you know, people retire from work. I never considered what I do as work. So nothing to retire from. I said, brother, you're talking about me too. So I do have an office at NPR. I show up every day, and I'll find something to do, and I'll be back on the air. Guarantee it.
Carl Everlasting, ladies and gentlemen, Carl Castle.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was